Meeting is now being recorded. Now being recorded.
Hello again, this is Jean-Baptiste from Icanorg. This is the afternoon session of plenary call 33, face-to-face meeting 4, and it's currently 12:30 UTC, and in attendance, same call as this morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Ellen. Negar Fresenio for the record. I just wanted to note that before lunch, we talked about coming back to the comments on recommendations 5 through 9 to see if we've addressed them all before moving on to the next recommendation.
Yeah, I think we did. There were some positive ones, and the non-commercial, which was in disagreement, and I think we discussed that one fully. So I think we're done. Thank you. While we're, however, on that one, Negar just said recommendations 5 through 9, and with regard to our numbering of recommendations and the NCSG comment earlier, this recommendation is called 5.1. We may change it, but the concept applies. Was that really a follow-on to 5, or was 5 a summary of, meaning it was from the group of 5 to 9? I think we want to go back and look at them all carefully and make sure that if we are saying this is a follow-on to recommendation X, that it is X. Where there was only one who is one recommendation, it's moot. But if it was a response to a group, it might be that we need to adjust some of those numbers. So we should take a look at that. Back to you. Sorry.
So we are now moving to the recommendations on compliance, recommendation 4. So here on screen is a general comment on that section from the registrar stakeholder group. Recommendations are supported by corresponding data, which does not seem to indicate the existence of systemic issues. And I'll move on to the recommendations itself. Recommendation 4.1. The ICANN board should direct ICANN contractual compliance to proactively monitor and enforce RDS data accuracy requirements to look for and address systemic issues. A risk-based approach should be executed to assess and understand inaccuracy issues and then take the appropriate actions to mitigate them.
Before we go on to the comments, this is one of the issues that there's some confusion on. When we talked to compliance and we asked, you know, do you look for systemic type problems? Do you look for patterns? You know, if you find that a given registrar has, you know, problem X reported multiple times, do you take any action on it? And their answer was, we respond to individual complaints. Susan, I think you can confirm they were pretty clear, saying they respond to individual incidents. Further discussions with both registrars and with the management above Maggie, including Jamie Headland, they implied that they do look for patterns. Moreover, when I was working with compliance, not working with, was talking to compliance, oh, about 7-8 years ago, just after, shortly after Maggie arrived, they were very proud of the tools they had developed that would demonstrate, you know, you could pull up any given registrar or registry and look at the kinds of complaints they got with them. So these two things didn't quite match. And the recommendation you see here was the result of it. My best analysis right now is that they feel very uncomfortable saying that they're looking for patterns, because to the common registrar, that may sound like they're looking for witch hunts and they're looking for unsubstantiated data. But my gut feeling is they are indeed doing this kind of thing, although they don't refer to it as that. So my general feeling is if we are going to make a recommendation like this, it perhaps needs to be more targeted than just the general statement, because I get the feeling that they, I don't know if they don't feel comfortable talking about it, or they're under legal constraint, or they're worried about how it will be interpreted. And I understand this is a public discussion who other people can listen to, but so I'm a little concerned that if we don't make it a little bit more specific, it may or may not have an effect, but it's certainly not going to get reported as such. And I have some worry. So before we look at the specifics, I guess I'm talking about the general concept of, do we want to make this exact kind of recommendation, or if we want the intent to go through, maybe we need to change the words. And Volker looks like he's just really would like to speak.
No, just to confirm what you're saying, I mean, there's definitely an undercurrent of what's official and what's unofficial compliance, what they are comfortable saying on the record. And maybe I shouldn't be saying that on the record, but and some of the issues that they may detect and not immediately act upon were used to inform some of the audit programs, and the selection of the audit program might also have been informed by certain results they got from complaints numbers and they received from certain registrars. I don't think it would be amiss to assume that a registrar that had extraordinary numbers of certain complaints would find themselves in as part of the audit program more regularly than other registrars would.
Despite her asking, I'm going to turn it over to Susan in a minute. But I guess part of the motivation for me for this originally is examples I had seen where there were multiple complaints issued. And, you know, very often those complaints were rejected on what were clearly spurious grounds. And therefore, if that indeed was happening on a regular basis, it makes it very unlikely they're acting on patterns if they refuse to accept the individual cases or issues. I don't think we've ever gotten a clear answer about why certain blatant accuracy complaints were rejected, accuracy being the easy one to talk about. When you report an email address which functionally is unable to work because of the way the DNS works and they claim is not a problem, you've got to wonder. So I still feel there's a need for a recommendation, but I'm not quite sure what it should be. Susan?
So just to back up a little bit to, the sort of quandary we're in with, what message are we getting? It was very clear in the first meeting we had with compliance, unfortunately I can't remember her name, but it was somebody Maggie had joined the meeting that, she actually works on the inaccuracy reports, and it appeared at that point as as they step through the process is, you know, here's the reported inaccuracy. We do this, 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 and this on this record, and then make an evaluation and close it, right? And there wasn't any attempt to see where, you know, were there other registrations, domain name registrations, that, you know, with that same inaccurate data in it, that they did not take it. But then I agree, then there was a confusion, you know, we were talking about the DAR data and Okto and everything, and Jamie was like, no, 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 we do more in-depth. But I think overall, when it comes to who is an accuracy, if a report is filed, they work on that one domain name, and you'd have to bring a more complex complaint to ICANN to get them to do something.
I guess, you know, and we're looking at a pre-GDPR world, so let's ignore the complexities of the new world. I guess I don't expect them, for every accuracy complaint they get, to go into domain tools and say, is there anyone else using this inaccurate address or email or phone number? You know, one, they should do that, but they should have done that, but I'm not really expecting them to do it. And with a large group where complaints are handled by different people, it's not clear who recognizes the patterns, but presumably they are collecting these in a system, and presumably you can run reports periodically, you know, saying where are the complaints and what kind are they, and are there any commonalities that we should have someone look at? And I think they may be doing that. But it's hard.
Which maybe that's appropriate.
Yeah, as I said, I think we still need a recommendation. I'm just not sure what it is. Because I...
So, this is Susan for the record. I mean, if you look at a risk-based approach should be executed. So if a risk is identified, then a one-off resolution to one domain name record is not sufficient, right? you know, and I always use the same examples, but for example, you know, when I worked for Facebook and I would report a domain name that used Facebook's information completely except the email address and certain name servers, that's a bad actor. There's no doubt that that's a bad actor. But I would receive a variety of resolutions to that inaccuracy. Nope, it's accurate. Yeah, but it's my data. Or my company's data. And nobody has the right to use this. Or, oh, yeah, suspend it immediately. And I really think it was more that it depended on the registrar. So, you know, the inaccuracy reports go to the registrars, right? So what we're asking in this is that ICANN actually, sending those over to the registrar, we ask them to take an action based on an identified risk.
What I've heard from a lot of people was that they misunderstood that recommendation as to mean that ICANN should actually go out and start digging, or compliance should proactively start searching for data accuracy issues, and we intended this, as I recall, based on the information they receive as part of their day-to-day operations, and they should make that analysis. And maybe we should make that more clear in the definition of the of the recommendation, to just say, no, we don't want ICANN to go out on fact-finding missions. We just want to use what you already have and cross-reference that.
Some of the additional information that, you know, David Conrad's office has. Because, you know, that was, to me, that's where this discussion started was, look, we know ICANN is bringing in all kinds of data and looking at it to secure the DNS. So why isn't compliance still using that data? And you know, and this recommendation was pointed toward the who is, but it's really like knew that, I cannot remember things. Who is the Gibraltar registrar that?
Altnames.
Yeah, we all knew Altnames was a really bad registrar. And lots of who is inaccuracies reported there. So therefore, they should have dug into more Altnames issues. And luckily, Altnames went up in smoke. I mean, Altnames is the worst stories I've heard, at least.
What if we make the kind of adjustment that Volker is talking about, and that's probably not necessarily in the recommendation but in the lead-up to it, and add a reference to the domain abuse tools Okto has developed? To say that compliance needs to be more proactive when there are strong indications received that there may be systemic problems. I'm not trying to wordsmith it, but so in other words, we're basing it, you know, in response to the registrar group saying they're not based on facts, we're basing it on input received, which may not be facts, but it's something meriting investigation. I mean, a complaint is not that there's a problem, but it's someone says there's a problem, and you have to look at it. And, you know, blatant systemic things that were reported through the, whatever the Octoprob thing is called now, DART, which was renamed to something else. You know, it's just an indication of something meriting some look. It doesn't mean you go audit the registrar. It doesn't mean you disembowel them or disenfranchise them or whatever, but you just take some sort of action. That sounds
well, palatable, maybe. I feel more comfortable if it would just say insert two or three words into the recommendation itself, use available, use incoming complaints to proactively monitor or something like that, just to make sure that the recommendation itself states it's this tiny limitation in scope that so many people were worried about, just to make it clear, simply because of the reason many people will only read the recommendations and not the reasoning.
I don't have a problem with that. I'd like to word it in a more general way so it factors in the other tools that might be made available, not just individual one-by-one complaints. You want to take a cut at rewording that? Okay. Let's go through the individual comments then. Jean-Baptiste?
Thank you. So we have a supporting comment from ALAC. Based on the review team's findings, the one with regard to data accuracy is a concern, R41, R42, CM1, and the ALAC looks very much forward to the board's response on how to handle this in the long run.
Unless someone has a compelling reason to comment when people are saying they support us, I don't think we need to justify it to them.
Then we have several other comments in this agreement. So first one is from the Domain Name Rights Coalition. Dangerous recommendation for registrants, which should be removed as untimely and beyond scope or narrowed in express language to a more narrowly tailored intent of the RDS WIS2. As the ICANN community researches, analyzes, and debates the WHOIS database of 2020, we should not be taking extraordinary efforts to review, cull, and delete registration of the WHOIS database of 1995. Unless there is some proof of illegality, then long-standing domain name registration, where the registrant is otherwise contactable, should not be suspended or or deleted due to failure of some data elements to be included or fully accurate.
I think what they're saying is don't enforce the RAA there, and that, I believe, is out of our scope. The RAA has provisions for what related to accuracy that are enforced by compliance in conjunction with the registrar that may eventually lead to a suspended domain. But that's policy. And I don't think that's within our jurisdiction to change that. Am I missing something here? Nor do I think we're in a position to say change the policy so accuracy is no longer appropriate. I don't think we're going to say that. So I think our answer is, as we read this, you are requesting that we essentially ignore certain current contractual terms. And, well, I don't know if they're consensus policies. Some of them may be consensus policies. Some may go back to the world as it was. I think that's the answer, though, because I think what they're saying is don't suspend a domain name because of inaccurate information, and that's outside of our scope. So I think that's the answer.
I think it goes beyond that, though. It says, I agree when you're saying that that's outside of our scope. I think the question here, comment made here, goes a little bit beyond that, and they're saying, if we are suggesting additional means to investigate, which I agree would be probably based on the misunderstanding of what we're actually suggesting, then that would put domain name registrants in a bad position, because then even more domain names would be suspended than what would regularly happen under the current processes envisioned by the RAA and policies. And I think that's the point where this comment is directed at. So by clearing up the recommendation, sure that we point out that it's only directed at the information that they already have, it's available, and just using that in a better way already takes care of a lot of that as well. So basically clean up the language and for the rest say it's anything beyond that is outside our scope, and that should be our response.
Thank you, Volker. I have a question. If a registrar is de-accredited and their domain names are transferred to another registrar, is that formally a transfer?
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's not a standard.
It's a transfer, but it's not a standard form transfer. So the ICANN transfer policy rules would not apply, but it's a transfer nonetheless.
But therefore, but,
and it's a non-charged
the data, the data accuracy verifications kick in.
No.
No?
They don't kick in because it's just non-standard, non-policy,
that,
non-standard
that was,
transfer.
That was the question. I was
from the escrow provision or that we derive in other means from ICANN. With regard to such a transfer, are usually relatively poor, and they require a certain amount of cleanup when they come into our system to make sure that our database stays up to date in a good state. So a lot of what is required by that policy would be instituted by us anyway, even though it was non-standard form transfer, just to make sure that we don't import bad data into our database.
You don't get the business data from the losing registrar. All you get is who is. So if the information is completely spurious, you have no way of contacting the registrant.
Yes, and that's happened. It has happened a lot of times in the past. When registrars, even well-known ones like Lycos, went belly up, we got data that was unusable, and that led to a lot of complaints from registrants who suddenly lost their domains because we had no way of contacting them or even knowing whose domain that was, and they kept losing domains.
So it's a problem that fixes itself. Lily.
Lily, for the record, so my understanding regarding this comment is a bit different. If you look at the comments from the DNRC, in a, so actually there were several comments from this group. So their comments were consistent. They're challenging in a post-GDPR age the legitimacy of. See, they also made a comment regarding the recommendation we just finished before lunch for the data accuracy. So they're saying, so in the EPDP process about the legitimacy of who is. And if, I saw the consistent way in this comment, like the recommendation, which is dangerous for a restaurant, and like for the WHOIS database of 2020 should be totally different from the WHOIS database of 1995. So I think we should take this group's comments as a group, not separately. And according to the comments from Catherine this morning, even in the post-GDPR age, so the data accuracy is still a requirement. So I would suggest we take the comments from this group, as a whole.
I think we have to look at them as a whole. I think we must respond to them individually. Just based on the form we're using, the technology we're using, I think we have to have a response. They may all be the same response, but I think we have to address specifically. You know, and if you look in this case, they say we should only be acting on things that are illegal. Well, very little response related to the domain name system is illegal. You know, these aren't laws; these are regulations that ICANN has put in place, so it's not a matter of legality or illegality. You know, the substance of what they're saying here is contactability should not be the basis for having a domain name deleted or suspended, and I think that's policy that we're not addressing. I mean, we could address it and say that policy should be changed. I don't think there's a desire in this group to do that. So I think we simply answer based on what they're saying here, that legality is not an issue, and we're not recommend that the accuracy policies be changed. And moreover, the EPDP has ratified at this point in projected answer that we not change accuracy requirements. So I feel comfortable in rejecting this without a problem. Go on. Please, Jean-Baptiste.
So we have other disagreements. So next one is from RSG. Where they view this recommendation as creating more risk by trying to place ICANN compliance into a more investigative mode, digging through data without justification. RDS accuracy is an obligation of the registered name holder. It is not the role of compliance to enforce RNH obligations. All right. RIC is in support of the previous comments.
Yep. Let's deal with them one by one. It's not the role of compliance to enforce RNH obligations. I thought that's exactly the... Volker?
There's a distinction to be made. The obligations of registered name holders is the obligation for registrars to enforce. The obligations of registrars to enforce that's the role of compliance. So it's a step removed.
Volker.
So basically, compliance does not enforce data accuracy. They enforce the responsibility of registrars that arises from certain contracts and policies with regard to data accuracy.
Compliance, in the simplest case, responds to a complaint. It may be a complaint for a domain that the validation requirements do not apply to, but they are allowed to enforce that, and you have to respond to it.
In any case, they're not enforcing the registrar's obligation to provide accurate data. They're just enforcing the registrar's obligation to ensure that their data is updated. It's
how are we implying something different in what we're saying? In no cases are we saying ICANN should approach the registrant.
Enforce registrar obligations with regard to RDS data accuracy requirements. I think that would just take care of that comment. Let's leave that part of the comment. Just clarify that compliance enforces and monitors registrars compliance with certain obligations that they have with regard to that, not the data accuracy requirement per se.
You look as frustrated as I am. Jackie Volker will help you in his wisdom reword this so that it is less offensive. You're not suggesting change the intent, you're suggesting changing the wording. We will take it under consideration with your help. All right, registries.
Supports the command RSG. Then we have NCSG. If the inaccuracies in the records do not cause harm, we do not see any merit in ramping up monitoring. Surely systemic issues present themselves through inaccuracy reporting. Routine sampling is expensive at a time of falling revenues.
Okay, I think the simple answer is we're not suggesting routine sampling. We're suggesting what are we suggesting?
Again, this is, a question of understanding what we actually set out to do. This is, they understand this as we want compliance to do more individual studies of inaccuracy data, like the ARS, and go out to find out if there's any issues, whereas we intended this as look at the data that's coming in, analyze that, and then find out if there's more that you can do based on the data that you receive. And again, like in the previous recommendations, we could just make that clearer in the language of what the basis of data that should be looked at is.
Okay. So I think it addressed in a simple way, we are not advocating additional sampling, you know, random sampling of the DNS in general. We may be suggesting that you start looking at samples from Registrar X if you get a huge number of complaints about Registrar X, but I don't think that would be called sampling. Next. First, we have to have lunch.
So we're moving to recommendation 4.2. The ICANN board should direct ICANN contractual compliance to look for patterns of failure to validate and verify RDS data required by the RAA. When such a pattern is detected, an audit should be initiated to check if the registrar follows RDS contractual obligations and consensus policies. Sanctions should be applied if significant deficiencies in RDS data validation or verification are identified. So supporting comment from ALAC based on the review team, same one as before.
Before we go on, make sure we understand, how is this different from the previous one? This essentially says, I think, that if you find something based on the patterns you now are recognizing in the previous one, this is the kind of action that you should take. Do I have that right, or am I missing something? Either everyone's asleep or they're agreeing.
I think the originating point is different. For 4.1, it's generated by the ARS project and also the who is in accuracy compliance. But for this one, for the 4.2, it was generated by the ARS only.
This is Susan. So I thought, to me, this is a little different than the first one, because when what we were concerned about, and if I'm remembering this correctly, Lily, August seems so long ago, is that in this one they're not identifying a risk per se, but I guess you could classify it as a risk. But in the inaccuracy reports, if one registrar or several registrars are always coming up with inaccuracy reports reported to compliance, and it was at a higher level than you would think it should be based on their registrations, then you would look at them to see, do they really do follow the RAA and validate and verify RDS? Because that's, you know, hopefully we have seen some of the improvements in data quality based on the requirements of the RDS, of the RAA for the registrars to take actions. And so, but if we're seeing a higher rate or percentage of domain names with inaccurate data that are being reported, then they should take a step further and actually look at those registrars to make sure they're following the process of validating and verifying.
The only requirement to validate and verify is in new and transferred domains. No?
There are certain other triggers as well, such as receipt of an inaccuracy complaint, or so the mains are transfer and renew, but there's other triggers.
No, I wasn't trying to be explicit, but by prefixing this recommendation saying should look for patterns for a failure to validate and verify as required by the RAA, that is a significant subset. Do we have evidence that that's not being done right now? of major failure?
What ICANN compliance actually does with the information that they are requesting, but part of every inaccuracy complaint that we receive is a question whether we are validating, verifying, and what methodologies we are using for that. That's part of the always returning questions as part of the inaccuracy complaint. If they actually do something with that, I don't know.
The question I'm asking is, are they getting significant inaccuracy complaints about registrations for which the 2018 RAA validation requirements are applicable?
Again, just make sure that the narrow focus of this recommendation is made clear, because I think that was the main problem that arose with the understanding of this. So instead of saying that ICANN compliance should go out and look for patterns, they should use the data available to them from incoming complaints to look for patterns.
To recognize.
Yeah. So I think that's the common disconnect that I've seen, at least from the NCSG and the whatever their abbreviation, the coalition that we have responses from, is. But
okay, I guess I was going back to a basic question of, is this recommendation exactly what we wanted? Because it only seems to apply to a very small subset of domains. And
I think it does, because the intent, if I remember back correctly to when we initially put this on the table, more of a question of, are registrars actually doing what they're required to do, and not as much as a requirement to the data accuracy in itself. So basically, we wanted to question whether ICANN compliance does anything to check that registrars are doing what they're supposed to, and with that target in mind, I think the recommendation stands.
Let's look at the comments one by one then.
Starting with the Internet Infrastructure Coalition, they invite the review team for more.
Before we do that, does anyone know who they are?
You probably know better than I do.
They're basically an industry coalition or group similar to the IAA and the MPAA of Internet service providers from all kinds of. They have in Germany, it's ECHO, whom you might have heard of. They're the international equivalent of ECHO.
And comprised of a lot of ISPC members.
Thank you. So they invite the review team for more assurances as to how patterns are defined and then detected. A review team should also scale the concept of compliance-based sanctions. I2C also points out this would benefit input from the registrar community.
Well, the last part is easy to answer. We have registrar community participation in this group. It was doing that before too. So we do have registrar participation in this group. Are we really in a position to define patterns? They're asking us to provide assurances as to how patterns will be defined and detected.
basically, I think they are asking, what do we mean by patterns? What is our intent? What is supposed to look for? Because it can mean many things that could be interpreted into this, I assume. And I think the registrar comment beyond that is the same. What are patterns of failure? What do we mean by that, actually? What are these three words actually supposed to mean? What are they for? So I think that's something that we can take care of in the reasoning for this comment, making sure that we explain what we mean.
I'm just reading the rest of it. Volker, the current audit program is a set of regularly scheduled audits, based on a sampling. I presume it also includes the ability to do an audit when triggered by specific reason that there is something to audit.
ICANN has the ability to perform up to two formal audits of a year. Normally, that is limited to the inclusion in the audit program. And unofficially, we've been informed that there might be a way that a registrar might find himself on that list more often if there are certain issues with complaints that they receive, patterns.
So, number one, we are not recommending anything outside of the current audit program. We are just saying that we are explicitly recommending that if there are regular issues related to compliance with the who is provisions of the RAA and the compliance, again, I'm not trying to word things, compliance recognizes that there are irregularities of a specific type that are recurrent with a given registrar, they may choose to invoke the audit program. Essentially that, I think, is what we're saying. Now, how you recognize patterns, I don't think we're in a position to define, but we can try to put words on it of, you know, similar complaints are recurrent on a higher than expected rate with a given registrar. So we can try to refine the wording, but I don't think we're looking for anything much out of the ordinary of what they're doing right now.
I would agree.
Okay. Nagar?
Thank you, Alan. Just one thing for consideration is for a recommendation like this where we're talking about patterns of failure, no parameters are put around that. It would leave it up to, let's say, the organization to determine what a pattern looks like. So if there are 10 complaints, it's not a pattern. If there are 100 complaints, it's a pattern. So it becomes very subjective. And as such, in the future, when we evaluate the implementation of this recommendation, there could be disagreements as to whether it was implemented satisfactorily if we have ambiguity how we are trying to achieve this. Just putting it out there because, you know, we've had issues like this in the past for implementation.
I don't want to be the one to always do the answering, but I guess if I look forward to the next review team, which I thankfully will not be part of.
You'll never know.
I can say that with a fair level of assurance. To be particularly outgoing on its reports of how it deals with registrars. I'm not quite sure how they would report on this. other than to say we triggered 6 audits in the last 5 years on registrars, which we would not have done other than based on this. So I think there's going to be an implicit vagueness on how this is addressed. We certainly can put some implementation guidelines that, you know, compliance should establish norms for the number of accuracy complaints per 1,000 domains that are sponsored by a given registrar. I always thought that term sponsored was an improper one, but it is the term that's used.
The registrars don't like it either, but it's the word.
So, you know, I think that's the kind of thing we're looking for. Maybe we should put some kind of statistic in, you know, establishing what that number should be. I don't know what the norm is. I don't know what the average is, so I have absolutely no idea. You know, I assume one complaint per 10,000 or something is reasonable, and 400 complaints per 10,000 is not reasonable, but it makes no sense at all in the real world. So we can certainly put in some reference to a metric that might be used without specifying exactly what the threshold is.
Or we base it on percentages of the domain sponsored instead of...
Isn't that what I just said?
Well, I guess that's not the way I interpreted the way what you said.
If it's 1 per 10, then it's 0.01% or something like that, whatever.
Okay.
I've lost track of where the decimal is, but I think we're all violently agreeing with each other. Yeah, and we should put some sort of metric in. So if we make it clear again, we're dealing on information that is received from valid reports of one form or another, and we add some comment about the metric, I think that addresses this. And we're not going outside of the audit program. Okay, next.
And the next one is from RRSG, where they would like to understand better how ICANN compliance would be detecting patterns of failure. As ICANN compliance already conducts audits on registrars who have proven to have a track record of non-compliance.
I think that's the one we just talked about.
Oh, sorry about that.
No, because we were talking about how patterns of failure and the audit and going outside the audit program. So I think we just did that one.
Okay. And then the RSG comment is in support of that. Then we have comments from the Domain Name Rights Coalition. Dangerous recommendation for... Sorry? Yeah.
Microphone, Lily.
That's correct. The same.
Okay.
Yeah. Dangerous recommendation for registrants, which would be removed as untimely and beyond scope, or narrowed in express language to a more narrowly tailored intent of the RDS WIS 2, as the ICANN community engages actively and with an extraordinary effort in the EPDP, which includes a review of what registrant data fields are appropriate in 2018 and ahead. Why should the RDS WIS 2 be calling on the ICANN board and staff to mine the existing WIS database for errors?
And again, here we mentioned that what is in the WIS database to be made available under limited conditions. The accuracy rules apply. The fact that it's not public is irrelevant. I mean, although the EPDP at this point is suggesting that some fields be deleted from the current WHOIS database, it remains to be seen if those fields get deleted, and in any case, they're not the ones that tend to be controversial. So it's not clear that the WHOIS database of 2020 will be significantly different from the WHOIS database of 2015 or 2010, for that matter. The public one certainly will be, but what's in the database itself is not necessarily different. So let's go ahead. I think we have an answer for that one.
And the last one from the NCSG. Given that the RAA will be under review because of GDPR, we recommend holding off on recommending new expenses, example given audits, until the new workload of the compliance team has been determined. Breach disclosures, for instance, are a new requirement for both controllers and processors. Monitoring for unreported breaches might be a more worthy candidate for compliance action.
They're right. But currently, for the registry agreement, I believe there are no current contractual terms requirement requiring disclosure of breaches, I believe. So there's nothing we can act on. And the EPDP is already looking at the GDPR has such requirements, and later we have a requirement that reporting breaches be required. So it's not up to us to say audit it, since it's not even a requirement yet. Although we could add, when we get to that one, a reference to this, you know, breaches should be reported on an annual basis by ICANN or something like that. Probably worth adding when we get to that one. So I think we're okay here.
That was the last one on 4.2. So we're moving on to Objective 6, ICANN contractual compliance actions, structure and processes. So here is a comment on the section itself from the business constituency. The many issues following the adoption of ICANN's temporary specification for GTLD registration data, temp spec, also should be addressed by the team. The business constituency is very concerned that ICANN compliance has failed to issue appropriate guidelines for registrars and registries and users of WHOIS, and also has failed to ensure even a minimum compliance in this space. The challenges identified in the APWG M3AA WG4 survey on the impact of GDPR WHOIS are also worth noting. As we review disclosure responses, we see overwhelming evidence that contracted parties are unresponsive to disclosure requests, and the responses received are not uniform across what is ostensibly a community bound by a common policy. We ask the team to recommend that ICANN org urgently address.
My gut response is this is so blatantly in the middle of the EPDP discussion that this is now out of scope for us. I mean, we can certainly say the review team strongly agrees that we need uniformity and consistency in how these things are handled, and I don't think anyone will disagree with that. Volker might, but... All right, I was trying to get some brownie points with him. We can't reject everything everyone says.
Of course not, but if we already decide that something is out of scope, then we should not comment on it.
Okay, he says reluctantly. But does everyone agree? It's a worthwhile comment, but it's nothing that we can address right now.
All right. Next one, still on the section, is from the Domain Name Rights Coalition. Recommendations calling for brute force enforcement of accuracy at the cost of canceling potentially thousands or more GTLD domain names is ill-advised. These are beyond the scope of the recommendations of the WHOIS1 review team, focused on contactability with the verified phone or email, and be untimely as the EPDP reviews whether the collection of these 30-plus-year-old fields even makes sense in the 21st century. Domain Name Rights Coalition also wonders why abusive use of the IRS hasn't been investigated, given that ICANN contractual compliance in this area and ARS are both new. They ask that the review team has a recommendation that the filer of a Who is Accuracy complaint is disclosed to the registrant. Registrant should be able to discover the identity who seek to harm their organizations, companies, or speech.
All right. One by one. Are we saying anywhere that we should use brute force enforcement and cancel registrations?
Yes.
Then I'll let you answer. Remind me what, how we're saying that. So our answer to this is we have that, but now that you mention it, Catherine?
This is Catherine. No, I think there may be different interpretations of what we have said, and possibly the interpretation that's at the heart of this comment is that we are recommending brute force enforcement of accuracy, and if maybe we should just review the language in the relevant section to see whether there's a need to further clarify. But otherwise, I mean, I think there are serious issues from a data protection perspective with disclosing the identity of the complainant to the registrant, depending on the situation. It certainly isn't something that you can just institute as a norm.
No. Okay, that was addressing the third part. On the first part, if there is brute force, I'm not even sure what brute force enforcement would be, and I certainly don't believe we anywhere have suggested, we've refrained from talking about, you know, the ultimate path of what happens if these things fail. But right now, if accuracy complaint is made and is not resolved, then domains are suspended. That's current policy. But I'm not quite sure how to respond to the brute force because I don't quite know what they're talking about. Lily?
If you're thinking about the comments, it's from DNRC. You should know that they're talking about the interpretation about data accuracy. They think the definition of the accuracy is contactability, not the accuracy we are talking about here. It's the data should be corresponding to the registrant as well. And according to DNRC, so for the accuracy, for the real accuracy, it's unachievable. So I believe the brute force here is from there, is from the interpretation of the data accuracy.
Any of this strike a chord?
I stated a little like a few seconds ago that I don't remember the explicit phrase brute force. So I don't think that that's – I think this seems kind of hyperbolic, but maybe I'm speaking out of turn. I don't know.
Okay. Barring anything else, I think our response is – We are not aware that we are recommending brute force enforceability, and anything relating to suspending domains other than what is in our current policies.
I think this goes back again to interpretation of what we're recommending. So I think from what I've heard from Kathy, who drafted a lot of that, is that she feels that the recommendations are a bit too broad and open to interpretation, what we actually mean. And by cleaning up that language, as we've already done in the previous recommendations, we could alleviate that or remove that misconception and
basically help them come on board with it. Okay. And the second part, I don't really
understand. We're never going to get Kathy to come on board, you know.
And I don't understand what they actually mean, the views of the ARS, because I think they mean the accuracy. Oh, no.
We have not had any report and any reports of abusive use of the ARS data. ARS data is only made available to compliance. So, Chris?
Just a sort of question for clarification, Alan. Are we planning on specifically responding to every comment that's been made that's negative?
That is our charge.
Really? Specifically to respond to every comment?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I must have got lost along the way somewhere.
Remember a few years back when people used to submit public comments and they never even got read?
Okay, so we could respond saying
no.
Read.
If you remember that, this is the reaction. The reaction is we as a review team or PDP or whatever go over each comment and put an answer. Maybe it's noted. Maybe it's we can but disagree.
Okay, so perhaps that's what I meant rather than specifically acknowledge receipts and say thank you, we note, is whether, because it seems to me that, you know, we could spend hours and hours getting down into the weeds and just and feeling the need to justify what we've said, and I just want to make sure that we don't really do that. I mean, in the same way, that the whole point about it is, that my understanding is this, and again, I must stress I'm speaking personally, this review team operates as a conglomerate of different views and tries to come to consensus, etc. Comments are... NCSG comments are consistent with NCSG and so on. So all I'm saying is I don't think it's necessary for this review team to get into a debate on the comments rather than simply just responding and saying, we know what you say.
Their perception is if we don't do that, it is perceived that we didn't bother reading them at all. Having spent untold hours in other groups with this, that is the world we have created. Nagar.
Thank you, Ellen. Nagar, for the record. In the bylaws, there is a requirement that as part of the report that is submitted to the board, there needs to be a section on the report where the review team addresses how they've taken into account the comments that have come in during public comment.
Right.
Yeah. So the idea is not to respond to the commenters, but there needs to be an explanation included in the final report.
Thank you.
As far as I know, the only practical way to do that is to make sure that we are comfortable, we have discussed each of them and accepted it, rejected it, or explained it. It is tedious. Sorry, go ahead.
So I back to Kathy's comment, when she talks about the abuse of the ARS, what she's talking about there, I think, is that people will who are trying to get a domain name deleted or just bug a registrant or a registrar will report continually the same domain name or a group of domains. And so it clogs the system. It makes a registrar do a check based on no real evidence. And it's And sometimes they're successful, supposedly, anecdotally, I've never really seen this, but I've been told that there have been times when somebody didn't have up-to-date information and ended up a domain actually got suspended and eventually deleted. So if you have, even for Facebook, we would get that and then, you know, a report. Mark Monitor would just forward it through and say, hey, you know, do something.
I understand what you're saying. That's not the ARS, though. That's the...
But I think that's what she's getting
at. Oh, okay. But the abuse of the complaint system...
Right.
I fully understand.
And if someone had mentioned abuse of the complaint system to us early on in the game, we might have chosen to look at it. But it's nothing that we reported to us, nor is it something we looked at. And it's certainly not the ARS. Volker.
I mean, we could respond to that in two ways. We're not aware of any abuse of use of the ARS because the data in the ARS is randomly sampled. That's the one way. Take it by what they wrote. Or interpreted in the way that they probably mean as to the reporting system by third parties, the accuracy reporting system, which could shorten that to ARS as well. And there we see some form of abuse from time to time, but there's no statistics on that. We just deal with it on the case.
Nor did we have it reported to us when we solicited input initially.
Basically, we...
Okay, I think we're covered.
Yeah, we're covered.
And the last one asks... the last one is reporting to the domain owner who the complainant is. And I would say privacy issues prohibit us from doing that, but that's a reasonable answer to give. However, I don't really know if that's a fact or not. Are you asked?
But you have a choice.
So what is our answer? The review team is not fully cognizant of the privacy issues associated with unilaterally releasing the domain, the name of the complainant.
Okay.
Claim ignorance when nothing else works. Someone catch that?
No.
The review team is not aware of the legal issues surrounding unilateral release of the domain name. It is an option given to the complainant currently.
Well, even as Parker was saying, the default...
Yeah, I just checked on the ICANN inaccuracy complaint forms, and it's the box that says, I do not want that to be disclosed, and if I do not want it to be disclosed, that's... then I have to provide a reason. So by default, everyone's disclosed. And I presume ICANN compliance looks at those reasons and see if they make sense and then decides on whether they forwarded the name or not. But we have no data on that.
I would think under GDPR, privacy is the default. I think we're done with this one.
Then Tolly comments on recommendation CM.1. This recommendation is the ICANN board should negotiate contractual terms or initiate a GNSO PDP to require that GTLD domain name suspended due to RDS contact data, which the registrar knows to be incorrect, and that remains incorrect until the registration is due for deletion, should be treated as follows. One, the RDS record should include a notation that the domain name is suspended due to incorrect data, and second, domain names with this notation not be unsuspended without correcting the data. First public comment is from RRSG in support. However, they reject the notion of the review team dictating contractual terms. RYSG supports that, and comment from ALAC, based on the review team's findings, the one with regard to data accuracy is a concern, and the ALAC looks very much forward to the board's response on how to handle this in the long run.
I think our response to the first one is the only mechanisms by which ICANN can change a contract are through negotiations or, if applicable, a PDP. And we are simply giving the board full latitude to use whatever tools are available.
I think this could be very easily redressed by just removing part of that first sentence between from the word should to the word to, so that it would now read the ICANN board should require that DTLD domain is suspended and so forth. And how they do that is up to ICANN. So not suggest how ICANN should do that and say ICANN should do that. I think that part would totally remove any question about what the registrars have objected to.
The reason we came up with that wording is ultimately, for instance, the board cannot negotiate a term. They can initiate a PDP. They have no control over the outcome of that PDP. Okay, so ultimately the board is not in a position to guarantee that this be done. We are simply saying the board should use whatever tools are available, and maybe we need to reword it. Now, it says...
Well, it needs some rewording anyway, because when we are renegotiating the RAA, we're not negotiating with the ICANN board. And it says that the ICANN board
Okay, it's not the ICANN board that negotiates anyway, so that needs to be clarified.
Just remove that entirely and make it up and let the board decide how they want to address that, and I think we're fine.
The problem, Volker, is when we started this discussion and started saying we want something changed, we were told that there is no way to change it, and there is no guaranteed way to change it. That's correct. But these are the tools, and you're right, the wording is wrong. It's not the board that negotiates. And maybe it's an initiate. Because negotiation implies we don't know the outcome of the negotiations. So I think the wording needs to be clarified so it's less offensive. But we are not dictating contractual terms. We are saying we would like, through whatever mechanism possible, to see this term changed. It may end up with a good result. It may end up without one, but one should use whatever tools are at our disposal. So I think that this needs... rewording, not dictating terms. We are suggesting such a term would be advantageous. Suggesting advantageous probably is not quite strong enough. But okay, we'll try some rewording on this one. Do we have a break coming up soon? I'm getting tired.
It's 3:30.
Okay. Oh, that's fine. It's only a half hour. All right, next one.
So next one is on recommendation 2. The ICANN board should direct ICANN organization to assess grandfather domains, domain names to determine if information is missing from the RDS registrant field. If 10 to 15% of domain names are found to lack data in the registrant field, then the ICANN board should initiate action intended to ensure that all GTLD domain names adhere to the same registration data collection requirements within 12 months. Support from ALAC on this recommendation, and the domain name recommendation requests deletion of this recommendation, as it, one, goes beyond the scope of the WHOIS-1 review team recommendation of contactability, and two, violates basic standards of due process and common sense. Such deletions would disproportionately impact registrants from the developing world who are already underrepresented in the online space. It may also impact users who are sharing local educational and community resources. Finally, this recommendation and the review of grandfather domain names with the possibility of mass deactivation should be tabled pending completion of the EPDP's work.
This, I think, will be an interesting one. On reading it again, I'm not sure why we ended up homing in on empty fields as opposed to something closer to what the ARS looks for of fields which would not meet the validation requirement. So can someone remind me of how we got from validated fields to empty fields?
Volker.
I think because empty fields are very easy for ICANN to detect, and validated fields is something for that the registrar might possibly know, but the ICANN would have no idea whether a field is validated or not unless they ask. And having to ask for every single field, for every single domain name, might be a bit of an onerous task for a review of all the domain names that are still considered to be grandfathering, because it's still quite a substantial number. But if they have the number of domains that they consider grandfathered, how many fields are empty there, that's something that ICANN can probably do.
I guess I didn't think of their registrar business. I thought of it as an ARS sample of 180 million.
That wasn't my...
Sorry? Oh, okay.
He expressed that. So the way I understand this is before 2009, you could, or before 2013, this is all becoming very foggy to me lately.
That's why I'm asking questions. I don't remember either.
So you could have, if a domain name was registered before the registrar sponsoring the domain signed the 2013 RAA, they were not required to collect the registrant field and the address? There's two.
I don't think you had to the registrant email address. That was something that wasn't.
Address. There was two.
Yeah, the registrant field was a lot shorter in the old days.
Yeah.
At least from the mandated part. Whether a registrar actually collected it and displayed it is a different question.
Right. So, I mean, it could be that everybody's been collecting this information all along, but they weren't required to collect two different fields, and I can go back and check that. So, therefore, this could become critical now when everybody's talking about data minimization, and if admin and tech, this was not a problem in my opinion when admin and tech was for sure being collected, but if we go down the road with EPDP and they decide on data minimization, then all of a sudden we have registrant records missing two critical fields. That's a problem. And there's no reason to have a policy that's, you know, bifurcated here. It's like we should have one policy for who is, and it could be that the EPDP will say, this is the new policy and we're doing this. But if we get into this, well, maybe we are, maybe we aren't, and it takes 2 or 3 years, this could cause quite an issue with the registrars would have their billing information, so they would know who really owns the domain, but we would have no right to ask for that information because they don't collect it. Or they're not required to collect it.
Let's not confuse what the registrar has as their person they're dealing with, entity they're dealing with, and who is the registrant of record. They may be completely different things for a number of legitimate or illegitimate reasons. Okay, lack data in the registrant field. That means the field called registrant. So that field was at some point optional?
No, the old registrant field itself was not optional, but it did not contain as much data as the other standard fields. So the admin C field was more verbose, had more data elements than the registrant fields in the old days. And I think that is something that should be addressed, but I think it's part the data we're recommending data collection requirements, and that's squarely within the scope of the EPDP. And that's a concern.
But when we're talking about registrant field, we don't mean just the registrant name. We mean the registrant name, registrant address, registrant email. So it's registrant fields to start with.
It's two of those. They have
if I may, the missing field in 2009 RIA is email address and phone number.
Phone number is not a mandatory field.
It used to be in the 2009 RIA.
Even for people who didn't have phone numbers?
I don't know the reason why it wasn't in there, but the 2009 RIA just didn't have email address and phone number as required fields for the registrant. Because probably they assumed that if somebody wanted to contact the registrant urgently, then they could talk to the admin. Was designated for that role.
But phone number is a mandatory field now?
It is. Fax isn't.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much.
Can we make that a recommendation?
I challenge you to say that in the EPDP. Please.
Drums and smoke signals, but all.
I'm just wondering, is it in large parts of the world, people have phone numbers, but... People have a phone number, but it maybe will be a temporary phone number that will change next week when they buy a new SIM card. So I just find that interesting if we worry about the global south. However, that's not the subject of this problem. All right. Are we still comfortable with the recommendation as it stands? I think it needs a little bit of clarification of what fields are we talking. If those are the fields, then we should. Now, the DNRC comment. I don't think we are suggesting mass deactivations. As a matter of fact, we're particularly silent on what would happen. However, the reality is, what would happen?
What would happen would be mass deactivations because we forced all the domain names under the that are currently still considered to be grandfathered under the new rules. That would require having to contact all those registrants, getting feedback from those registrants. And if we don't get that feedback, then these would be suspended. That is the logical course that would happen because if we have to touch the registration changes, change fields, don't get feedback for those changes, then suspension is the only contractual option that we have besides deletion.
Assuming a reasonable transition period. Pardon me?
Even then. I mean, if you deactivate now or deactivate in a year, doesn't make much of a difference.
I was thinking more like 10 years. But.
Well, I assume that in 10 years the grandfathering issue will have resolved itself with domains being deleted and transferred.
That's not clear to me.
Well, if you look at the ARS and the graphs, I've zero with the grandfathered domains. That will peter out at the end. Sure about that. There will never be zero, but the trend's clear.
I think this recommendation was, with the threshold of 10 to 15%, was if you're right, then this recommendation will result in nothing. If you're wrong, then it says we have to take some level of action. I would guess it would be constrained by renewal dates and a variety of other things, though. So, you know, given that you can have a domain for 10 years, it might well be 10 years. Okay, so I think what we're hearing is we can still live with the recommendation. If Volker is right, then the test will be done, it will fail, and the recommendation goes up in smoke.
Yeah, I still have a problem with that because ultimately the entire 2013 RIA and the obligations that go with it and the transition process were part of an extended negotiation program between ICANN and in this case the registrars. the result that was reached was a carefully designed compromise that was designed by ICANN and the registrars to take into account all perspectives on this. And one part that also had been understood by the parties at the table at that time was that usually the registration data accuracy is an issue for domains that are used for abusive purposes. If you don't have a domain that's not being used for abusive purposes or there's no registration in that, then the accuracy requirements don't become that urgent because there's no actual need for that data to be 100% accurate or for the registrant to be contactable. Because let's face it, if you don't need to contact a registrant because he's not doing anything wrong, then you probably don't need to contact the contactability to be as strict and as stringent as for registrations that are being used for abuse purposes or where certain things go wrong. And the older name gets, the less likely it is that there's problems with that registration, that you will need that contactability. So I would argue strongly that for the domain names that are still grandfathered, whenever this kicks in, there's not actually a problem with that data still being missing unless we find some overarching reason why the contactability for such old domain names is such an important goal that to risk the deactivation of those domain names.
Let the record show Stephanie Perrin has joined us.
Well, we took all the data accuracy evidence before. Not even kidding.
Okay. Volker, I guess I disagree with you because we're talking about contactability based on who is data, which is different from contactability by the registrar, as you and other people have pointed out multiple times.
I'm not saying that. I'm saying that contactability becomes less of an issue of the registrant by anyone, becomes less of an issue the older the domain name is.
There's no question about that. I don't think anyone's arguing that. But should a situation arrive where one wants to contact the registrant, ultimately, the whole purpose of WHOIS is that we be able to do that. The number of times registrants need to be contacted compared to the 300 million domains is infinitesimally small. We know that on the general case. Could we close the blinds a little bit? Right now the sun is directly in my eye, or the reflection of the sun. Thank you. So, clearly, if this recommendation were to be put in place, ultimately, how does one handle the situation of a registrant who does not respond to any queries by the registrar? Remember, the registrar also sends them queries saying your credit card is expired and things like that.
We don't need to figure out how to handle that because that's already in the agreement. The failure to respond to a valid inquiry by the registrar is a breach of the contract by the registrar, which must actually, under the ICANN contract, be enforced by either deletion of the domain name. So having to force the registrar to reach out to a registrant already triggers a mechanism in the RAA that forces the registrar to take action if no response is received. And I think that is part of the concern that if we make it necessary for the registrar to contact the registrant to make any kind of modification, then you trigger a deactivation down the road for a lot of domain names.
Microphone.
This doesn't completely pertain to our discussion, but it sounds like you're saying that no matter what the new registration data policy is, that the registrars will advocate for not touching them for that. So those old registrations will never, ever have to pertain to the new policy comes out of the EPDP.
Never ever is too far. I think, like I said, the grandfathering mechanism foresees certain triggers where the registrant would come to the registrar and make certain requests, such as the transfer of the domain. And in those cases, then this domain name would no longer be considered grandfathered and would have to adhere to that, those mechanisms as well. So if I don't like GoDaddy anymore and want my domain with Key Systems, then I have to say goodbye to my grandfathered status for that domain.
Okay. Don't agree with it.
My microphone on. Volker, you did agree to this as it is currently worded in the draft report. Does that, is what you're saying now, saying should we have a consensus call for the board, you would not agree with it this time, or you can live with it based on it being a compromise?
Well, before we go there, can we see if there's any other comments? It surprised me that there's only two. So I think before we go there, we should see all the comments and
okay.
Make a decision based on
valid.
What we see.
Next one is from the RRSG. Very problematic. The RRS studies have shown that the number of grandfathered domains is already decreasing steadily on its own, illustrating that there is no strong need for a complete removal of grandfathering privileges for pre 2013 RAA domain names, which would create significant implementation issues for both registrars and registrants. The terms of the 2013 provisions were negotiated by ICANN and the RRSG under consideration of the realities of the domain business and difficulties in having to reach out to existing customers. The review team also does not demonstrate reasonable fact-based need for removing the grandfathering rules if an existing registration that predates the adoption of the 2013 RAA by the sponsoring registrar is not causing any issue, there needs to be a compelling reason to impose sanctions. The presumption that sufficient time has passed since the adoption of the 2014 RAA is erroneous, as registrars have been adopting the new RAA over time, not at the time it was introduced by ICANN. All right.
Comments, anyone?
I think I just raised those comments. It's amazing.
Should we put on the record that Volker has agreed with the registrar's comments?
Yes, please do.
Let's go on, and then we'll talk about them in general.
Thank you. Then the RSG comments, they are concerned with the wording, who would be the party responsible for taking the action described on domain suspended due to RDS data. RSG echoes the RSG's concerns that the review team should not be dictating contractual terms and believes the recommendation as written is imprecise and potentially problematic.
Okay, open discussion. Over.
I'm not sure if I could add anything to what I've said before in the comment as written here. The last point is valid as well. I think we've had that discussion before, though, so we need to go over it again because this is a discussion we've had over and over in, before we came up to this recommendation. I'm not a big fan, so I would support anything that cuts into this or removes this, but obviously there's strong feelings on the other side as well. And I think one thing that we should maybe consider in our response to the registrar stakeholder response is to actually demonstrate the need for the removal of the grandfathering rules for such domain names. If we can demonstrate an actual need that is understood by all parties that, oh, yes, that's a valid reason why we actually need that, then I think that would go a long way of making that argument. If we can't, then we should consider removing that recommendation.
Does anyone, and I suspect the one, I think I'll give you the floor next, especially since you may have an answer for me. The reference to the ARS data showing that the number is decreasing, does anyone have a handle on what those numbers are? I think Lily may be able to pull them up.
Yes, Lily, for the record. So first, my comment is regarding the fact-based needs. Since the subfields are missing for the grandfather domain names registration, I think it's a fact-based needs already. Considering the email address is super essential for any investigation, we can use that field for correlation or expanding our initial assessment. I think, yeah, the substantial fields mission is already a fact-based needs already. And for this question, if you can recall, for the first ARS report, there are around 40% grandfather domains. So the review team considered it was really considerable portion. And even now we see a descending trend on the grandfather domain. It's still around 30, if I'm not wrong. There are still 30%. And we made a compromise to a 10 to 15% if the domains are missing the fields. It's already a compromise. If we are going to remove the recommendation wholly, I think, yeah, so no matter what percentage the grandfather domain will be there, so there are still considerable portion of the grandfather domains are missing the substantial fields over there. There will not be any solution in the future. I reiterate Susan's point that we really need a consistent policy. Since the 2013 RA, it has been coming into effect 5 years. Why we should keep like two formats of policies? There is no reason.
Thank you. Of course, the 5 years means that's when it was available. Some people may only have signed on to it very recently. I know Stephanie is in the queue. The reason I was asking the percentages is I wonder if we can take the ones we have, and it's only a limited number over a couple of years, and do any projection on how on when, in fact, that number goes down to become negligible. I suspect it's a relatively long period, but I think it's worth trying to do that projection. Volker and then Stephanie.
2 points, one of which my constituency might kill me for, but I'm getting to that last. First point is that one part of this recommendation that always struck me as a bit odd was that we're not basing it on any existing numbers that we know. We're saying only 10% of grandfathered domain names should have no, if they don't have contact details, then certain mess. But we don't know what that number actually is right now. We don't know where we are operating from, what the timelines are, what the grading is, as in how far along that road that we are, that target, how far away from the target are we currently? We know how many domain names are considered to be grandfathered or not. We don't know how many of those domains actually don't meet those criteria. that we are setting for removal of the entire grandfathering prohibition. So that's something that I would really like to see, as in, do registrars only have to contact two registrants to make sure that this that we are under that level? Are we almost there? Or is this an enormous amount of effort that has to go into this one? As in, how easy is it to make that trigger happen or not? I think that's something that we should consider. That's the first point, and before you respond, I would come to the second one. One reason I think is compelling and should be made by our group is that if the admin contact and other contact are removed, then the registrant contact without an email address or telephone number would mean that no contact would be there with those details. And I think that's the problem. That's the main problem. Our focus might be on ensuring that a contact exists that has these details, rather than make sure that the registrant contact definitely has to happen. Okay.
What I was going to say, Stephanie, next is I wish we worked in an environment where we could simply say, can someone please tell us how many of the 180 million domain name, grandfather domain names, and that was the estimate we got, have no entries in those fields. Domain tools can probably do a simple query and tell us at least what it was 6 months ago. They can do. They still have their data now. No one's taken it away from them. I don't even know who to ask to get that kind of query done, and maybe it's as simple as asking the question and trying to get a definitive answer now and deciding whether this is a recommendation we need or that we're already under that threshold and it's moot. Pardon me? Stephanie?
Position and with Kathy Kleiman's group's position. Secondly, I do think we're really stretching for ways to be relevant here on this recommendation because I can't see the point of spending a pile of money when we're going to have a new policy coming out of the EPDP. And more money will be spent implementing that policy. So to ask for more work when, as Volker just pointed out, we don't actually know what fields we're going to come up with as recommended fields after EPDP, this may fix itself because if you're going to delete some fields, you're going to have a contact point. So why don't we put it on hold? Rather than a recommendation, why don't we note that there is an issue and we don't have stats for it? And on the matter of domain tools, they should be dumping those records because they aren't obtained lawfully under the GDPR. So if they better not be able to still do a search. Thanks.
If we can't get the data, then we can't get the data. This recommendation will not be acted on until after that the EPDP has for delivering a product. Whether they do or not is rather moot. So we're not spending any money until then. And the fields we're talking about here, you may not have been here when we started that discussion, are the registrant, telephone, and email. I doubt if the EPDP is going to be deleting those two fields. Volker?
I think a compromise that a lot of registrars would be able to live with is to align this recommendation with the EPDP results in as much as to say that ICANN should ensure that by the time that the EPDP is implemented, that all contact fields that the EPDP requires to be there for a domain name ensure that at least one contact has those fields. As in, say, if the admin C is deleted and we say there should be an email address or there should be a phone number, then one of these contact fields that exists has to have that data, regardless of whether they're grandfathered or not, because that would pull them back in.
I would suggest that it has to be the admin or registrant. The technical contact may well be a very different entity that has no connection with the administration of the domain. So it's specific. We are talking about one of or a pair of the admin or registrant must have a telephone number, and an email or any one of the four is sufficient. I would suggest any one of the four may not be sufficient, because a phone number is not necessarily a particularly reliable way these days.
It really depends on what the EPDP comes up with. If they say only phone or email, then we can only demand phone or email. But
EPDP is not likely to come up with that recommendation at that level.
Okay.
Well, can we welcome our new attendee? Erica Mann has now joined us after a laborious walk here from Germany. For the record, the trains are on strike. Susan.
So the first half of this recommendation was to see if we do have a problem. So if they get through the first part half, which seems to me that with GDPR, who knows how hard this would be. But then there may be no problem. Maybe that data is being collected. But what I'm really concerned about is that you just confirmed to me that you did not expect the new EPDP temp spec, whatever we're going to call the new policy, to impact the old domain name. So if that will be a registrar, well, he
I just said
that.
I don't know what they come up with and what the ultimate result will be. And it might be a problem, it might not be a problem.
Right.
If we, for example, say there should be no more admin C contact, which might be a foreseeable outcome, then having domains that have nothing in the registrant field for those for either email or telephone numbers might be a problem. That should be addressed. If, however, the admin continues to exist, so there is someone representing the registrant
mm-hmm.
that has that data available, then the problem is not as bad as any other circumstance.
Volker,
I'm just saying we should take into account what the outcome might be, outcomes might be, and tailor our recommendation to catch what we actually intend to happen here.
And I disagree, because you've seen what has happened in the past, so there's not a lot of trust there. And this recommendation, I would have a problem if we change it substantially.
Thank you. As Stephanie noted, Volker, question. In the hypothetical situation you just described, we are deleting the billing and admin contact, which is the current position of the EPDP, and we have a registrant field with no information in it. You're saying it would be reasonable at that point to say it has to have some contact information, otherwise there's no way to contact the registrant. How would registrars handle that, given this discussion we've had more than one time on the difficulty of contacting registrants and the consequences of not being able to contact them?
It's a good question. It would be a very, very troublesome and onerous process. But in that case, we would understand the need for that, because we agree there should be someone who has methodology of contactability in their data, whatever the contact may be. And if these elements that have that contactability are suddenly removed, and they're having just very short registrant fields that's missing essential information, then we understand the need that there should be some information there. And depending on what the EPDP comes up with and depending on what the processes are available to us, these data fields must be filled. I agree with that 100%.
And your colleague, you know, put money on the table, your colleagues will agree.
I will make them.
Can I quote you? No, I will not quote you. Stephanie,
for the record, I was going to comment on the applicability of the GDPR to this whole problem. There has to be a contact point for the benefit of the registrant for breach notification alone. I don't know what the billing, how you guys handle billing for these grandfathered guys, but you don't. Yeah. 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 So they do need that. But they don't need two. They're going to have to, the EPDP, whether it likes it or not, is going to have to address the necessity test for the collection of double contact points. And in the EWG, we came up with all kinds of contact points, which I don't think is going to, we'll know better after the two cows case gets all the way through court, but it's unlikely we're going to have both the phone number and the email, in my view. And I think the email is probably going to be anonymized. So that's just a view.
Let's not confuse what is made public with what is stored in the database. Okay.
But you still have to have a necessity test to collect it.
Someone has an email address, even if you only present an anonymized version.
You still have to pass the necessity test to collect it. You don't get we're always talking about this disclosure business. We're not.
Stephanie, that's the EPDP's problem. That's not the table we're at here.
Sure, but if it, yeah.
What I hear you saying and Volker saying is if grandfathered clauses post EPDP result in no contact information, we have a problem for whatever reason.
Correct.
Okay. Volker said, and I think you said, that maybe two pieces of contact information is too much.
Yes,
no, you need one working. I learned a long time ago that if you rely on one piece of information, it's probably will fail at the wrong time. So we can consider that. We're not debating that here. Okay. Well, we can't define what you actually try to use it. And we're not going to try to use I'm not going to be the one to call 180 million registrants to see if they're there or not. I have better things to do with my life. What I'm hearing from Susan is she believes it is really important to have contact information for the registrant. I think I'm hearing the same thing from all of you. Susan, if you were told that you have workable contact information for the admin, registrant field is empty, would that satisfy you? Now, remember, we haven't at this point considered after the EPDP who's going to have access to any of these fields.
Susan, for the record, it just makes me more concerned because, you know, if for some reason the EPDP policy only touches up is only touching new registrations from the date it's implemented, well, I didn't realize that the 2013 RAA didn't apply, so I just don't think that you can say that. or I'm just not going to agree and have the faith that it gets put in place, it makes reasonable sense to take a look at this. I don't think it would be that hard, or if they, ICANN can tell us. Take a look at this, you know, this is millions of domain name records, and I think that the security of the DNS would be harmed if we end up in a situation in which we have no contact information available, even in under any, like I could file a UDRP, but there's no email address collected, so therefore you would not be able to contact the registrant in that manner, for example. And so I just don't have faith in the system that this is not needed because of what's going to happen in EPDP. We can't predict that. This is an existing problem that we saw. I think it needs to be solved, and I think these domain names need to be looked at.
I think there is some violent agreement going on here, using slightly different terminology.
I think it's enough difference in the terminology to be dangerous.
All right. Nothing we do here is going to affect what happens until next July at the earliest, and NAGAR's estimate is the time. If we deliver a report by the end of January, the board rules by the end of July, it is likely to be at the earliest the end of 2019 before an implementation plan is delivered. Okay. So we're not going to see any implementation prior to that. If what we say in this recommendation is, again, not wording the recommendation, but the recommendation preamble, is we currently believe there are about 180 million grandfathered domains which may not have any contact information. And if they do have contact information, that contact information might be deleted due to whatever comes out of the EPDP. They might only have admin contact, and the admin contact will disappear. How that happens, we're not going to ask. May I finish? Okay. Since it is essential that there be some contact information for every registration, that I think we can make a much stronger recommendation than this by generalizing it. Instead of simply saying if there, I mean, right now we're saying if there's only 14% of the fields that are empty, I can do nothing. And what Volker's saying is that there's 14% of 100, what will maybe 150 million domains by that time. That's, I don't know, a large number. 25 million domains or something like that. 15%, 10 to 15% of 100. Okay, 10% of, I can do 10%. 10% of 150 domain, million domains is 50 domains which will have no information in them, and that would be just fine. Volker is saying that's not acceptable. So
no information is not correct.
No contact information.
Even that, you will have street address still in there. This was just the email and
Sorry. What he said about contact information. Okay. So I think we're moving towards a stronger recommendation than what we have there. What's worded?
Well, I mean, this is Susan. I'd be open to seeing other language. I'm not gonna, you know, that's fine. We can work through this. But what I am saying is, unless that recommendation was very, very clear, I do not want to find myself in a situation 3 years from now where registrars say, nope, can't touch those, and we weren't required to collect the email address and phone, and we are not agreeing, and I mean, registrars have all the, you know, and the registry has all the power in this situation, they can just dig their heels in and say, we're not going to do this, it's not going to happen, and then we end up with with records that do not include a registrant email and phone. That is a dangerous situation.
And for the record, I agree. I don't think we should have domain names without any records for any of the contacts.
In the end, may I?
Well, then you don't. You don't know. Nobody knows because nobody's looked at this.
No, all he said is we should not have. He didn't say we don't have.
You say you don't.
No. No, we do not want.
I thought you said in your registrar you don't.
Dependent. Dependent on the outcome of the EPDP, we may end up with a situation that both you and I don't think is tenable.
Okay. Now, the registrar will still have contact information, but not something that, for instance, a UDRP provider can get access to without legal action in the country of the registrar. All right. We're already on soft ground. We didn't use the appropriate words at the end of this recommendation, as we talked about before. That is, the board should either negotiate or initiate a PDP. It says the board should ensure. The board has no way of ensuring. So, again, I think we need the right wording there. And, yes, ultimately, registrars can dig their feet in, and in the old ICANN, there would be absolutely no recourse. In this new modern ICANN, we can remove the board if they don't do what we want. Right, Chris?
You turned down. I'd like to see that.
You're supposed to believe that empowered community power has teeth. If you joke about it, we know you don't consider it serious. I think we can come up with something that we can live with. It's going to take a little bit of work. So the three of us will skip dinner tonight. And
no way. I make my choice.
All right, but we're going to have to do some quick work to get back on the table sometime tomorrow. Volker?
Yeah, just to reiterate, I think the logic compromise is to modify this, that considering that registrant fields have not do not necessarily have full contact information due to grandfathering rules implemented as part of the 2013 RAA, and considering that the EPDP is considering to get rid of certain other contact fields, this would result in a situation where only one contact field would exist for the registrant or representing the registrant that would not have the full fields as envisioned under the in GDPR compliant, whatever you may have. We consider this to be a situation that is untenable, and therefore we would recommend, and then the recommendation would be that at least one of the contact fields representing the registrant after the implementation of the EPDP should have full contact details. And the registrar, and then make it a recommendation action what the board should have.
May I take that offline? Because yeah. The full contact details is different from one of. So let's talk about it.
As required under the EPDP.
Okay. I think we may have a compromise that will work and, in fact, be a stronger recommendation. And how it gets implemented, Lord only knows. I mean, right now we may have records with no contact for admin or the registrant. So, okay.
And I think we moved right through the break time.
Then it is break time now.
All right. Where is that coming from? Okay. So starting again after the break, we're now on the recommendation CM3. I think that's from here, right?
Yeah.
All right. So we are back on recommendation CM.3. The ICANN board should direct ICANN organization to review the RDS records of GTLD domain names sampled by ARS for each region to determine whether lack of knowledge of RDS inaccuracy, reporting tools, or other critical factors are responsible for low RDS inaccuracy report submission in some regions. So here, starting with three supporting comments, first one from RRSG. They have doubts, however, that the inaccuracy reporting function will remain viable in their current form under data privacy regulations, as such data is no longer publicly accessible. As such, any review or study of this tool may be a misuse of resources.
I'm not sure why you class this as supporting.
So those are the only people who use the form, and they reported support, but, yeah. Has doubts, yeah.
I guess first I have a question on the recommendation. I understand the intent. How would one attribute motive, however, to try to understand why there are so few reports? Susan, I think it came from you, so I'm sort of asking you.
Yeah, actually, in reading it now after a few months, it's like, there's a lot of problems with this. It seemed to make sense before.
Shut down.
I guess what I was trying to get at, was we know we have a problem in the Global South. And there's very relatively little, small numbers of accuracy, use of the accuracy reporting tools. And if there was something in the domain name registration itself that might give us a clue, or the organization a clue, to what, of the few that are reported, why are they reported, and, you know, is there any information we can glean from that? But part of me thinks that this is probably not a way to go about it. I mean, the outreach might be better.
Well, okay, I think the gist here is that the ARS shows there is inaccuracy, but no one is reporting them through the other methods.
Mm-hmm.
And I would think that is when we talk about doing outreach, we should simply add a footnote, a subpart of it, to say, you know, there may need to be a particular focus in the Global South because, and cite this as a rationale, and delete it as a recommendation.
I would sort of agree, unless somebody, this is Susan, unless somebody can remind me of other reasons that we decided on this.
Yeah, I'm concerned because I don't like making recommendations where I have no clue whatsoever of what the methodology would be to do it. And although it's for all good intentions, I'm not sure one could. It's hard proving a negative. And how do you demonstrate why people aren't doing something? It's either they don't care, there are no maldoers in the Global South, or they don't know about it. But how do you go about determining? So I think delete this as a recommendation, add it as a more targeted focus on the outreach, and leave it be. And just for the record, the comment on the Registrar Stakeholder Group saying ARS may no longer be possible is not, I don't think, is relevant to this discussion.
Okay. Maybe that also ties into how relevant are domain names in the Global South? I mean, if you look at regions such as Africa, domain names are not really the main use of the Internet. It's mostly telephone payment services, and this may not be as relevant in the Global South as a region, or parts of the regions that are included in the Global South and in the Global North.
I
don't think it's quantifiable.
I guess I disagree with you at some level. I realized perspectives are different. For instance, that I haven't been there in 4 or 5 years now, but last time I was in Tanzania or Kenya, names on trucks and bulletin boards and stuff all the time, always using the CCTLD, not the GTLD, and that's what struck me. But so the names are being used. They strongly often focus on the CCTLD, but they are relevant. But I think what Susan is saying is the ARS shows there are inaccuracies, but no one seems to care. And it's an interesting thing. I think it may mean that we need more outreach, but I suspect there's also an issue of CCTLD versus GTLDs. All right, so this one we will delete. We will respond to the comment noting we'll deleting it, but whether the ARS can continue or not in the future, you know, is not a factor.
I think they stuck that into anything they might have.
So, Lily, did you have any comments on that? I mean,
my memory regarding this recommendation is also generated by the compliance report. There is constantly a lack of inaccuracy report from the Global South and even for some African region, I remembered. So the previous discussion was focused on whether there is a lack of knowledge of the tools, reporting tools. So I agree, this is part of outreach efforts as well.
Yeah, that pretty well matches my memory. All right, let's go on to the next one.
All right, next comment from the RIST is, what is the desired outcome? Review team should make that more explicit and consider revising this recommendation accordingly. Sorry, did you mean this recommendation? Okay.
What we're doing, we're deleting the recommendation.
Yep. Yep.
And our response, we will respond to the comment anyway, saying that the existence of ARS in the future is not relevant, but we are deleting the recommendation in favor of moving it into our future.
All right. Recommendation CM.4. Recommendation CM.4, the ICANN board should direct ICANN organization to publicize and encourage use of the bulk WHOIS inaccuracy reporting tool or any successor tool. There is support from ALAC. The Domain Name Rights Coalition finds this recommendation unnecessary, as there have been only three have reported inaccurate RDS WHOIS records in the last year, and only 10 individuals registered for it, and suggest the reporting tool should be deleted rather than promoted.
Just shows how you can interpret the same data in different ways. All right. In reverse order, the registrar stakeholder group comment says that it's unlikely that a bulk tool will be compliant with under GDPR or other applicable data protection regimes. I don't believe it is a given. I do believe that there are significant people in the registrar stakeholder group who believe that should be the outcome, given that there is a strong position that under GDPR, registrars should not be obliged to distinguish between geographic localization nor legal versus natural persons. But it is not a given that that is the outcome at this point. And so I don't think we can presume that all of WHOIS is going to be blacked out going forward. So the bulk reporting, not disappear, and bulk reporting may still be applicable. So I think we have to work in that world. Volker.
Can we make that recommendation dependent on such a recommendation of the EPDP to make it clear that provided there's still a means to gain bulk access to WHOIS data, the promotion of tool to provide bulk WHOIS inaccuracy as the bulk analytics WHOIS tool may be beneficial to the community, because otherwise it doesn't make sense. There is no way to gain bulk access data. This recommendation goes nowhere. So why not make that clear at least in the reasoning?
I have no problem with that.
I don't think this is dependent on bulk access at all. Is that what you're saying?
I think he used the term bulk access not in the domain tools form, but in a...
I wonder how you're going to make a bulk WHOIS inaccuracy complaint without having access to domain names on more than on an individual domain basis, which seems to imply bulk access in some form or shape.
No. I mean, we're doing it now. We're not reporting them via bulk access. But one of the reasons, so I came up with this one, one of the reasons was is because I do a lot of Whois stuff and only found out about the bulk access stuff a couple of years ago. So I thought, well, if they've got the tool, they should allow, you know, they should publicize it. It's a pain to do one-offs. With the zone files, you always get the domain name, so you get a list of newly registered domains or updated domains. So that's the bulk list that you need. And then you just do a bunch of one-off lookups. Yes, it used to be easier, but it is not. But you could easily, I mean, like I ran across a registrar that but they didn't even put redacted in. They absolutely left all the information off except their own registrar information and name servers. The name servers are on the Whois record. But, you know, it was over 100 domains. I looked them all up individually. And I could simply plug those into the bulk Whois instead of filling out every little form on them. So I think it's a good tool.
I mean, certainly one of the reasons ICANN has not wanted to publicize it widely is once it's submitted, it gets transformed into individual tickets. And that doesn't always make sense either, because if they are all indeed reporting the same sort of problem, perhaps with the same registrar, it's not clear they should be. But that's a methodology problem on their side.
Right. That doesn't mean that.
Volker?
I just wonder what we mean by publicized and encouraged use of, because I've just looked at the main ICANN website about Whois inaccuracies, and they're making it clear that there's such a tool, and they're giving instructions on how to sign up for that. What more do we want? If we want them to publicize it, then they could just say, oh, we're already doing that. I think we should be clear in what we want with this publication. Not just say they should do more, but what exactly we want ICANN to do, and especially ICANN board to do. Does this rise to the importance of a recommendation if it's something that could be done on an afternoon by someone working on the ICANN webpage by making a couple of more references, if we could get that done? I mean,
for example, this is Susan. I don't disagree with that. The more detail we can give without being overly prescriptive is that best. But so last summer, I actually went through the process and applied for it and didn't use it in 3 months, and then they revoked my permissions. I'm like, thanks a lot, guys. And the reason I didn't want to burden them with a bunch of, because I wanted to see where this was all going, you know. So now I have to go through the process again.
You put a strike on your mark already.
Yeah.
Well, for a lot of it.
All right, Volker, where did you find this under?
I basically Googled for bulk Whois inaccuracy and landed on the ICANN website about Whois inaccuracy. So I'm putting the link into the chat on the Adobe.
No, I'm not on. I never did get on Adobe Connect.
Maybe you should then.
Maybe I should.
It's ICANN.org resources pages. And then inaccuracy -2013, -3, -22.
Why don't we first solve the problem by getting on Adobe Connect? What is the
RDS review? RDS review, one word. So participate ICANN.org and then. For example, what I could imagine is just as part of the inaccuracy reporting page, put a reference in there. That would be, if it's not there, I haven't checked yet, but that would be a logical place to put this information.
Yes,
and that's But I still think that's something that we could just informally ask someone at ICANN to put on the website instead of making it a recommendation.
Because we can negotiate. We're willing
it's a minor
to,
thing.
We're willing to remove the recommendation if they put it onto the website. Yeah, there is a page on compliance complaints there. But there's lots of things on the ICANN website Google will tell you about that ICANN won't.
And I've been told informally, not from the client, they don't want to have it.
Oh, no.
But why? It makes no sense. Partly because... Yeah. No, because then people can decide...
Yeah, but that's you, Susan. All right, action item for Alan to write to contractual to negotiate the entry. Is the page that it should be on the one called ICANN.org/compliance/complaint?
Just one reference. I'm looking at the compliance complaint page now before you where you have the different complaint forms linked to. And the Learn More page is actually that page which I linked to earlier. So it is included on the Learn More About page. So I'm not sure what more we can ask for unless we put it on the form itself.
Sorry, I don't.
On ICANN, the ICANN website, you have
complaint submission and Learn More.
That's the same page.
And
that advertises that service.
Where do you see it advertised?
In the second paragraph, ICANN also provides a mechanism for bulk QoS inaccuracy or complaint submission, which allows us to use it and so on. And on the bottom, we have to inquire about access to the bulk complaint tool. Please email to compliance@ICANN.org, subject inquiry about.
I have no idea what page you're on.
Okay.
Put the list.
If you go to the ICANN.org page and then /compliance/complaint, okay. And that's the website where you have all the different complaints types, where you basically get to the forms where you make the complaints. And when you go to the bottom where it says OOS and accuracy, the first column is Learn More, and that's the page I'll link to in the
ICANN.org/compliance.
Yep.
You see, I foolishly went to the menu and selected compliance. It gives me a completely different set of things there.
Well, that goes back to, I think, Stephanie's point of needing a librarian to make sure that the ICANN page is navigable, but Google gets me here.
There's the pictures here. Who is an accuracy complaint? No, that gave me a document.
If you go to complaints on the page with the pictures, you go to complaint submission and learn more. And
then
the same page.
See, there's another complaint submission and learn more that takes you to a different place altogether. Oh, no, it doesn't. All right, so now I get to a table.
And on the bottom of the table, there's the who is an accuracy. In the first column, you have the learn more column, which is the one that I linked to earlier, and that has that information.
Who is an accuracy complaint form?
I'm not saying it's easy to find. I'm just there.
Someone trying to talk? I still can't find it, but that's me.
I am willing to write to compliance if someone tells me where it should be or how to find it.
But like I said, that's probably going to be the response. Look, it's there, and why didn't you find it?
If there's any Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy here, we can talk about how to hide things in plain sight. All right. We will see if we can negotiate getting it more evident and delete the recommendation. Is that the decision? Done. Next. Stephanie.
Stephanie Perrin, for the record, just in passing, this form is no longer compliant with GDPR. Should we be pointing this out to ICANN.org?
No?
Well, it says if you want to update your data, but it doesn't mention the fact that ICANN's control of that personal data. So, exactly. Yeah. I don't know that it is. As long as ICANN's controlling data.
Stephanie, we're not going to have the debate about who the controller is right now. Please, let's not.
No. Apparently, I just missed a call on that lovely topic.
Such is life.
Speaking of which, are we going to have a break for the EPDP call tomorrow morning?
I've booked off for me.
Yeah.
It's middle of the afternoon. Next.
Thank you, Alan. We are on recommendation CM.5. The ICANN board should recommend that GNSU adopt a risk-based approach for incorporating requirements for measurement, auditing, tracking, reporting, and enforcement in all new RDS policies. And we have three public comments and support from RRSG, LYSG, and ALAC.
I have a question on this one. Is anyone going to know what it means? Passing this on to the GNSO as written.
If the board has to have a little tutorial on what taking a risk-based approach means, then possibly that's a good thing.
Sorry, I missed that, Chris.
It's merely for us to recommend to the GNSO that they do something.
You don't have to understand what it means.
One assumes, given that the registries and registrars have said they support it, that they understand what it means. Of course, they may not understand it means the same thing.
But we can wash our hands of it. It's not our job at that point.
Are you arguing for more detail, Alan? Is that why you raised the question?
I raised the question asking, do we need more detail? If everyone is happy to not, I'm delighted to pass it on. We may never get another recommendation that everyone supports. Done in record time. Next. We may be able to leave before tomorrow.
So the next topic is recommendation 10, privacy proxy services.
And I think the mechanism that we have in there has already been triggered, as far as I know.
Same point, yeah. No worries. So recommendation 10.1 is the following. The board should monitor the implementation of the PPSIA in the event that the PPSIA policy does not become operational by 31st December 2019. The ICANN board should propose an amendment to the RAA that privacy proxy providers affiliated with registrars verify and validate underlying customer information provided to them in the same way as registrars are required to verify and validate other registration data. So here we have two supporting comments, one from Business Constituency and ALAC. So first one is, it is unacceptable that ICANN continues to delay implementation of this approved consensus policy, and we ask the team to address this in their report. ICANN should be accrediting proxy privacy and requiring compliance now. Second one is support from ALAC. No comments. Then we have a neutral comment from NCSG. If registrars do not object to this requirement, we cannot see a reason to object. However, the first recommendation on privacy proxy services would be to do a financial review to ensure that the results of the IRT have not forced the service out of the marketplace. There is no focus on cost in this document, and maintaining an open and accessible domain space demands a focus on cost.
They premised that saying if the registrars don't object, and the registrars did object. So let us look at their comment.
All right, the two disagreements, one from RRSG. The RRSG believes this recommendation seems to overlook that privacy proxy is a service, same as email, and therefore the underlying customer information is already being verified and validated by the registrar. In essence, this is requiring the customer info to be verified, validated, which adds no value. The RRSG also rejects the notion of a recommendation dictating contractual language. Contracts are the sole remit of ICANN and the contracted parties, and RRSG supports this comment.
I don't think that's true.
Which part is not true?
Registrars that they already are. Not all of them are verifying, validating, because I've seen a lot of the underlying contact data, and there was no way in hell. And that registrar recognizes that and will immediately suspend the registration.
Just to be clear, are these registrations that predate the RA, the 13 RAA?
No, but I'm not sure that is applicable here. I mean, it was more of like, you know, I mean, there just was no information in the, or it was so nonsensical, it was ridiculous. So, I mean, if the registrars all want to sign on and say, yes, they are doing that, then maybe we have a different recommendation. But I do not think that every registrar is doing that. And so I would hate to let go of this.
Just to go back on the history, registrars are required to validate information of their registrant. It is unclear if the registrar has a captive privacy proxy service, whether they are similarly verifying the information that is being kept by the privacy proxy service. And that was the rationale for this recommendation. If a registrar has a captive privacy proxy service and is already verifying it, then they've ticked off the box. We're not asking for it to be done a second time if they are doing it as part of their regular process. If they are not doing it, if they believe there,
if they believe there is a loophole that says because the registrant of record is the privacy proxy service and not the original registrant, they no longer have to verify that information, then this is blocking, this is taking out that loophole. So I'm not quite sure I understand the... stakeholder group comment is saying it's already being verified by the registrar, in which case, fine, done. But we believe, for reasons I don't longer remember, that that might not be the case in all cases. Volker?
It has always been my interpretation that the accuracy in the verification requirements hit upon this the domain name meeting a certain trigger. Trigger event. Basically, if it's newly registered or transferred in, then you have to verify the information that the registrant has provided. And whether you then apply a privacy service on top of that or not for those privacy services that are affiliated with the registrar is irrelevant to the question of whether you have to perform the validation and verification. At least that's my interpretation of the contractual language. If other registrars interpret that differently, I wouldn't know about that, but it has been my impression that if the privacy service is affiliated with the registrar, i.e. operated by the registrar or an affiliated entity, then the contractual obligations with regard to verification and validation of the registrant provided information obviously apply. They would not apply if the privacy service provider is not affiliated with the registrar as a third-party provider, because we would not have any access to that data when the data, when the domain name, for example, is transferred in. But otherwise, it would have been provided. And I would be interested in learning more about your experience, Susan, because it strikes me as an odd way of handling that.
This one was added, I think, during the third face-to-face. Because remember, we were very late in doing privacy proxy. And I'm trying to remember, and I can't, what the trigger mechanism was that caused this. Clearly, there was a belief that some registrars are verifying the details of the privacy proxy service as meeting their the criteria in the RAA, because that is the registrant of record, and not necessarily validating the information, the underlying information. But I'm having a hard time remembering the history of how we came to that conclusion that it might be a problem. Stephanie, and then Susan.
I can't remember whether I, for the record, raised it at the time, but I am concerned about the focus on affiliated proxy services as opposed to unaffiliated proxy services. So if we wind up in this situation and there's a kind of a doubling down on registrar-affiliated proxy services, while we're unable to do any of the unaffiliated ones, doesn't that have a disproportionate effect on the marketplace?
Well, in theory, yes. But there's nothing we can do about it because the only people we have contracts with are the registrars. So we cannot require someone who has no contractual connection with us to do anything.
Sure, but I mean, from a regulatory perspective, you don't, you go ahead and, the other guys, you don't go ahead and pile on the guys you already regulate.
Well, that,
you know?
That's what we're trying to do, but we're saying, should the privacy proxy PDP not come to
I know, I understand that.
Can we get partway there?
Spelling it out, I don't think you can discriminate further about the guys you already regulate. That's not a fair process. Spoken like an ex-bureaucrat, but, you know.
Since the registrars did not raise that, I
feel I'm obliged to raise it at this point.
Because they didn't think of it doesn't mean it isn't valid. I mean, does that mean that they're the only party here whose vote counts on that?
I'm more concerned.
Fundamental fairness. It's part of work stream two, is it not?
I'm more concerned at this point with, is there a need for this recommendation at all? And if not, oh, sorry. Lily, please go ahead.
So regarding this recommendation is from first generated by the data accuracy findings. So during the ARS project, whenever they encounter a domain registered under the PNP service, they just stop there since there is no accreditation standard for PNP service. And it was already a contractual obligation for registrars to validate and verify the registration data, even PNP service. So far, since there is a missing for the accreditation system for PNP service, no one touched upon the WHOIS data, who is utilized the PNP service. So I believe this recommendation just to identify the needs in the future once we have the accreditation system established. Just make sure the obligations depicted in the 2013 IA, there is some enforcement of that obligations.
I guess my problem is there any evidence that the captive PNP services are not, for new registrations and transfers, are not effectively doing their validation today? If you look at how a registration is done, you put in all of your information, and typically with a captive service, you tick off a box saying, I want to pay an extra $2 a month or whatever, and have my information hidden. Is there any belief that there are registrars who, once that box is ticked off, decide to skip or omit the verification validation requirements? Remember, because there is a validation requirement and a verification within 6 days or 7 days or something else. Susan, please.
So my experience for a major proxy provider is they would send me, now this is almost 2 years old of the information, I mean, from when I was still at Facebook, but they would send me the information and say, if you believe this is inaccurate data, please let us know and we'll take action. So why would they even suggest that? Why wouldn't they just say, here is the WHOIS data associated, or the underlying contact information data associated with the registration? I don't know if they validate the email address or not, but the data was so poor in probably 30 to 50% of the cases that it was very easy to write back and say, yes, this data is no good and you need to take action. So what they would do then is sometimes they would just suspend the service, proxy service, but sometimes they would suspend the registration.
Do you have any belief, though, I won't say evidence, but certainly belief, that these were registrations that were done under the 2013 RAA? That's the only obligation that registrars ever had to validate the data was under the 2013.
Yeah.
based on anecdotal experience, but if you participate in the privacy proxy debate, you know, PDP, which I think you did.
No, I didn't.
No, you didn't? This is definitely an issue for people in similar positions to what I was in.
All right. Let me try to summarize. The registrar stakeholder group is generally saying, we're already doing this, therefore you're asking for double the work. I think we need to clarify through wording or whatever that we are not requiring a second validation, but we believe it is an obligation of the registrar to perform the validation for domains that they will pass on to their captive privacy proxy. If they are already doing that, as Volker says, he believes he is and others are, then it's a done deal. It's no problem. If they're not doing it, it's correcting them.
Yeah, but I agree with Susan here. If this is actually a question of if they're doing this or not, which I hadn't known, and none of the other registrars that debated this comment apparently were aware of either, then this becomes an issue where it would make sense to just point that out, that this should be applied on a general scale. Maybe also indicating that where this is already carried out by a registrar as part of their contractual obligations under the RAA anyway, a duplicate, of course, doesn't have to be applied, but there has to be for each data set that a registrar accepts a verification and validation, no matter whether that registration ends up under privacy or not. I think that's reasonable as a request. Yeah.
So we need to make sure the wording is clear, the recommendation stands.
Yeah.
Okay. Next, registries agreed, so... I think we're done with this one. Are we not?
It could be just one.
Then the answer is, as we're reviewing this document, we verify that the wording is crystal clear, and no other action necessary.
Recommendation 10.2 is the following: reviewing the effectiveness of the implementation of WHO is one recommendation 10 should be deferred. The ICANN board should recommend that review be carried out by the next RDS WHO is review team after PPSIA policy is implemented.
Done.
Only support.
Next
on the agenda is the wrap-up.
Didn't we table something earlier, or did we already catch up to that?
Yes, there was single who is priority. We're waiting for Carlton. As you prefer. And on single WHOIS policy, if I recall correctly, there was only one public comment, so that's pretty fast.
Interestingly, we omitted a half hour item and we are finishing 15 minutes short. So that's not bad. We did take a slightly longer break at one point. So we're on time, which says something about our estimates. And I don't think we need to do anything else today unless Volker wants to talk today right now about rewriting that recommendation, whatever it was. I can't remember what it is now.
I'd like to sleep on that.
Okay. Then I think we adjourned. Unless there's any further wrap-up, do we want to go over
what we have done at this point, or? At the meeting right now. Technically, the next item is confirm, approve recommendations, findings. The question I'm asking is, do we want to do that right now or not?
This is Negor for the record. We've taken notes on the recommendations that require action. Given that some of them are going to be rewritten, there doesn't seem to be much need to review them at this point because we will need to work with some of the review team members to rewrite recommendations, and I don't think there is any action to review anything just yet. That's the question, but of course, Alan, it's up to you.
It's fine with me. Jean-Baptiste, do you want to quickly review what tomorrow looks like, and then we will adjourn?
Sure, but it also depends whether we move single WHOIS policy to tomorrow or not. But tomorrow we will start with welcome, with day one takeaways and day two objectives, and then review the public comments received on common internationalized domain names. Then there is the morning break. Then we continue the review of public comments received with plan and annual reports. Then objective two, anything new. 1 hour lunch break, and after that, objective three, law enforcement needs for 2 hours. And after the afternoon break, we'll review the public comments received on Objective 4, Consumer Trust, and finally the wrap-up.
I am somewhat optimistic that the first two items, the common interface and the internationalized domain, will be done in less than the time we've allocated.
Mm-hmm.
We've almost an hour and a half for them. And hopefully we'll be able to squeeze in Carlton's at the same time and make up for the difference. I'm just looking at the comments we had on those two, and I think we'll be able to pull that off. So. I think we are meeting at 7 p.m., dinner at 7 p.m., and I presume it's a 10-minute walk away.
It's close to it. It's like next door to the restaurant where you met last time. So for those who want, we can leave 10 to 7 from A-Loft. Yeah, in the lobby. Yeah. Yeah.
It's called Meet Meet.
And we'll stop the
recording. Double E and then EA. Your Google phone will tell you where to go if necessary. But if we leave altogether, we don't have to rely on that.